From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Contact with nature is not some magical elixir, writes Stephen Keller. Rather, the natural world is the foundation on which we build our existence.
Kellert is Professor Emeritus and Senior Research Scholar at the Yale School of Forestry and the author of the new book, Birthright, People and Nature in the Modern World, which releases today in paperback. In the book, he shows that our ability to think, feel, communicate, create, and even to find meaning in life all depend on our relationship to nature.
Modern society, he argues, has become adversarial in its relationship to nature, having greatly undervalued the natural world beyond its capacity to feed, shelter, and clothe us.
Not only our daily source of vitamins, minerals, and protein, but one of intellectual, spiritual, and moral fiber as well. Mm-hmm. Stephen Kellert joins us to discuss this topic and his book in the first half of the show.
And in the second half, Nell and I will catch up on some news items, including carbon dioxide hitting a new record in the Northern Hemisphere, California continuing to dry up, sink, and create jobs all at the same time.
And rise.
We'll explain how. Fracking and seismic activity relationships. And finally, China reaches its Cuyahoga River moment and decides to do something about it.
That's right. All of that in the second half. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. It all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Canyons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Jeff from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates, and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and across the board is Chris Cherniak. Mm-hmm. And on the phone with us for the first half of the show is Professor Stephen Kellert. He's Professor Emeritus and Senior Research Scholar at the Yale School of Forestry and author of the book Birthright, People and Nature in the Modern World. And that releases today in paperback. Professor Kellert, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
So a lot of this book is kind of based around the concept of biophilia, and this is something that, you know, we've never talked about on our show before. Why don't you give like a brief overview, if that's
sure.
possible, of this concept and what it means?
Well, it's a relatively simple notion. The idea is that we have an inherent inclination to affiliate with life and life-like processes, the natural world, the world beyond ourselves, of which we're a part because we evolved for most of our species history, 99.9%, in adaptive response to natural forces and stimuli, and only recently have we mostly lived in a human-created and artificial world. So we're still deeply biologically inclined to respond to cues and stimulants from the natural world. The argument continues that this continues to be instrumental. It's not a vestigial tendency that developed in a past that no longer is relevant, but that it continues to be instrumental in people's physical and mental health and well-being.
So you say we can't flourish, you know, as individuals or as a society without this strong relationship with nature, but you feel confident that we will get back to that point. Maybe we've gotten away from that right now, but you feel confident that our society can strengthen that relationship. Why is that?
Well, I don't know if I feel confident. I'd say I feel optimistic.
Okay.
don't know if I'm totally delusional or not. It's a guess at this point. But people have a marvelous capacity to adapt to circumstances given various pressures and constraints. That doesn't mean they'll actually do it. I mean, the thing that biophilia, as I mentioned, is a simple concept. What makes it complex is that, like most things human, even though we may have a biological impulse, we rely on experience and learning and development to make those impulses adaptive and functional. And so there's latitude in that, which gives us the opportunity to sort of stretch our biology and be very creative in response to those impulses, but it also gives us an equivalent capacity to work against ourselves, to be, in a sense, self-destructive. I do think that people have, in modern society, have moved away from an appreciation and recognition of how much we continue to depend upon ongoing beneficial contact with nature to be healthy and whole. But I also, in response to your question, believe that people are becoming more cognizant and aware of the benefits of becoming more in-tuned or enhancing their contact with the natural world, especially when it's demonstrated to them that it's in their self-interest.
Right. Let's talk about some examples of how biophilia or biophilic design has changed over the centuries. Can you give us some examples of biophilia, say, in the 18th and 19th century, and then how things changed, I would assume, in the 20th century?
Well, that's a good question. I think we've always intuitively understood this dependency, and yet it's been deeply ingrained in our culture that the measure of progress in civilization is to somehow transcend our biology, to move away from that. And that's always been kind of a dream, in the sense, to become immortal. But we didn't really have the capacity to do that until fairly recently, to believe that we can manage and control and modify the natural world to such an extent that, whether it be in medicine or urbanization or in architecture or in food production and in other ways, that we could actually so manipulate and so manage and so control nature that we could, in a sense, remove and isolate ourselves from it. And I think that sort of aspiration or that hope was deeply ingrained in our culture for a long period of time, I'd say probably thousands of years, and it existed in the 17th and 18th centuries or before, but our dependency on the natural world was so much greater than that. I think people had that kind of experiential connection, and it reflected itself in many of the ways in which we either grew food or we built buildings or we manufactured products and so forth. And in the 20th century, the triumph of technology, in a sense, allowed us to kind of, as I say, increasingly remove, if not isolate and alienate ourselves from the natural world and this illusion that we didn't really need it, or that if nature was important, it was only as raw material that we could transform through our cleverness and technology into something else, or maybe a recreational amenity. You know, certainly nice, but not necessary, and something that was dispensable.
Right.
And so in the 20th century, I think we, in many aspects of our lives, you know, again, large-scale food production, massive manufacturing of goods and services, a medical model that kind of, you know, to dependent upon a sort of suppression and of other organisms and an antiseptic approach. Our urbanization, our architecture, it really became very isolated and from the natural world in a lot of ways. And the triumph of that, or the most developed expression of it, was modern city, that where there was not only wholesale transformation of the natural world and suppression of it, and modification of it and export of pollutants to it, but also where there was a great deal of isolation, personal and experiential isolation from it. And I think we're now coming back slowly, very, very slowly, to a recognition that this is not a prescription for health or productivity or well-being over the long run.
Right, kind of a, as you're talking there, kind of I'm visualizing kind of a shift from a biological, natural-based dependency to a chemical-based dependency in many ways with respect to energy, food, medicine, and humans kind of synthesizing chemistry in a way that we believe is much more beneficial to us, much greater control over that.
Very much so. And, a good friend and a person I'm sure you're aware of, someone I admire greatly, David Orr, referred to it as promiscuous chemistry, that, where you would just kind of isolate a particular element or characteristic of what you wanted, independent of everything else, particularly the ecological context in which we live, but also other kinds of aspects of society, and just develop it to its absolute possibility, given the limits of our knowledge and technology, with the interest of creating certain kinds of outputs that we wanted, whether it be food outputs or suppression of other organisms or manufactured products or a construction of buildings and cities and so forth.
So in the book, you say, even in today's world of accumulated knowledge and powerful electronic communication, the natural world remains the most sensory-stimulating and information-rich environment people ever encounter, which I had never really thought about before reading that sentence, but it strikes me as very true. So what are some of the impacts to people of evolving in such an environment, and what are some of the benefits of spending time in that kind of environment?
Well, you particularly see the benefits in children and children's development. If assuming for the moment that biophilia is a real thing, and that is this biological impulse that needs to be nourished and developed in order to become fully adaptive and functional, it's of course going to be most important during the most important learning period, which is childhood. And I'm not putting down the computer and the incredible capacity that we developed in modern society to mobilize information and make it available to people in extraordinary ways. It's a marvelous aspect of modern life. But nonetheless, when a child develops the world around it that is so salient for the development of their cognitive capacity, their emotional capacity, their language capacity, which is the basis of culture and learning, is the natural world. And it occurs in such a subtle and fashion. But, the natural world is just, how does a child know a duck from a seagull, from a cardinal, from a, just talking about birds, from a robin? Sometimes their parents teach them these things in a very deliberate way, but most of the time they just assimilate like sponges all the variability that they experience, that is weather and vegetation and animal life and smells and sounds and visual differentiation, and all this is at the basis of their developing their capacity to differentiate and develop the capacity to form categories and taxonomies, and as I say, is at the basis of intellectual development and language learning and a mathematical capacity, if you will, just counting and differentiating. And children do this by using the resources that are all around them and in a very contextual way that's almost invisible. But that information richness is mostly in the natural world. And even, you know, if you look at young children's books, for example, you know, they're not, you know, whether it be counting or learning names or, you know, it's one hippopotamus, two giraffe, three, you know, camels. It's not one paperclip, two pins, three pencils. You know, it's things that are vivid, meaningful, and that's just the vicarious experience. Of course, the direct experience, you know, we all just absorb the things around us by looking at them and interacting with them in a very subtle way. All that is part of that information richness and sensory stimulation. And also part of it is the surprise and the uncertainty and the way in which the natural world changes. And all this is part of the stimulation and information richness that makes it such a wonderful environment for learning. And, of course, the environment is the environment that we have evolved and still live in.
Right.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Professor Stephen Kellert from the Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies about his new book called Birthright, People and Nature in the Modern World. So, Professor Kellert, another aspect of our experience in nature with nature that you talk about is these particular moments in time that have, you know, may have a particular impact on us and be very memorable. And you talked about one of yours being, you know, seeing the Grand Tetons for the first time or snorkeling in the Caribbean. I know that when I, you know, read that part of the book, I immediately thought of several moments in my life that have stuck with me that have all taken place, you know, outdoors and in nature. What kind of impact, lasting impact, do those specific moments have?
Well, that's a great question that we don't really have the answer to. We have hints of it, and it appears that there was a wonderful book called Ecology of Imagination in Childhood by a woman named Edith Cobb, in which she looked at particularly creative people. But, you know, we're all creative in a sense, but she was looking at people whose creativity was so nurtured and so expressed and so widely recognized that she could see these characteristics of their childhood that seemed to play an important role in their creativity. And much to her surprise, she was a psychologist or psychiatrist. She was not an environmentalist or somebody predisposed to, she wasn't an outdoors person or naturalist, but she was surprised that the great majority of these highly creative people across widely different areas, you know, music and art and science and other realms of creativity, had moments in their childhood that they seemed to go back to and, you know, seemed to be very poignant memories. And almost all of them occurred in nature. Now, you know, you mentioned how I talked about in the book, you know, my experiences in the Grand Teton or snorkeling in the Caribbean. And those are, you know, we can all think of those incredible moments in spectacular places. You have many of them out in Utah. We have less of them here in Connecticut. But for children, very often they're quite mundane. And we can all remember, you know, kind of creating a world of wonder, mystery, and excitement and adventure in the most mundane and ordinary habitats, and very often our backyards. And, so the spectacular places are certainly part of it, and I think especially as you grow older, the spectacular places become more important. But as a child, they're less so, but they still are as I say, places of rich with wonder and possibility. And an example of that, Gary Nabhan is a very good ecologist and anthropologist, wrote a book with a fellow named Stephen Trimble called The Geography of Childhood, I think it was something of that sort, and he talked about how bringing his children to some place like Yellowstone and showing, you know, and exposing them to Yellowstone Falls and thinking that it would be so exciting, and he kind of looked over to kind of get his children to look at the falls, and they were, you know, playing on the side of the road and with great enthusiasm and excitement, but they had created in the, you know, a very simple environment, very special moments for them, and uh, some, sometimes we call them touchstone memories, that are just as important as the spectacular places. And they're, you know, both of them can be complementary, but the ordinary can be just as amazing. In fact, in some ways, the ordinary is more important from a developmental point of view than the extraordinary, but they're both important.
Well, then let's talk about your childhood. Give us a quick sketch of, did you have experiential moments like that as a child?
For sure. I can think back on certain moments. Sometimes they weren't pleasant. Some of our most poignant moments are those ones where there was a lot of fear and adversity, and we kind of got over it, and that's part of the its meaningfulness. But I can think of quite a few little adventures that were misadventures. I can think of building little dams in a creek in the backyard, and again, ordinary. When I look at these environments now, it's almost embarrassing because they really weren't much. They seemed pretty spectacular and amazing at the time, but right. Looking at them from the perspective of an adult, they weren't all that significant. One lament, though, and I think this is something that many people experience, maybe less so for you folks in Utah than here in the more crowded Northeast, but is that many of these places that were very special to me as a child, they might have been an apple orchard, or they might have been a creek, or they might have been an abandoned lot, kind of leftover countryside, as someone once called it, are no longer, and that's part of the sadness of the pace and scale of our development, is that many of these places that were so important to so many of us during early developmental years have been degraded and developed in ways that make them no longer accessible to young people. And Robert Pyle, an entomologist, a specialist in butterflies, nonetheless wrote a wonderful book called The Thunder Tree, Lessons from an Urban Wildland, when he was growing up as a kid, and he talks about something he calls the extinction of experience, and is concerned that young people today, both because of the pace of development as well as the pace of technology that removes young people very often from ongoing contact with the natural world, that all that together has created a diminution of experience. It's extinction of experience is a great expression because it gets your attention, and obviously that hasn't occurred. I mean, people have still have experiences, but there's certainly been a rapid decline in what might be called free play experiences of children in the outdoors.
Right.
So one question that we often ask our guests, and that follows up on this answer well, is how did you get into this field? How did you start studying this as a profession and start publishing on this topic?
I started out, focusing very much on wildlife and wildlife conservation and being concerned about species that were under stress for one reason or another, usually typically because of their problematic interaction with people. And I started out particularly interested in, say, the osprey, fish hawk, and how it had declined so precipitously because of the effects of DDT and other pesticides, and then moved on from there to other species, very often wilderness-dependent species, such as grizzly bears and wolves and so forth, and realized that my interest was not so much the biology of these species, but the biology of the interaction of our species with these species that had resulted in those problems. And this whole area of kind of human, in that case, wildlife interactions, which morphed into more general interest in human-nature interactions, was relatively unexplored area, at least in a fairly empirical, systematic way. And so I went, so it was an opportunity for me to kind of, dive into an area that I thought was important and that we knew relatively little about. And I, you know, and then it just went from there. I developed a sort of a typology of ways in which people value the natural world. And then I began to recognize that these values were universal, even though they might take on different shapes and forms and content depending upon circumstance and culture and things like that. But nonetheless, they seem to be universal. And then if they're universal, of course, that suggests that they're embedded in us biologically, and then that invites questions about what is it in our evolutionary biology that would make these responses, these values adaptive, et cetera. So, you know, one thing leads to another, and that's how it kind of evolved over time. And if you don't want me here for 2 hours, I won't tell you anymore.
Well, I do want to know, how long have you been teaching?
Too long. Well, I start teaching in the late 1970s,
okay.
And I actually have stopped teaching. Professor Emeritus means you're no longer teaching, although I have agreed to teach an undergraduate course at Yale next year. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided I wanted to put my energies at this point mostly into not theory and science, but more application. And I just felt like I couldn't do it at the scale or level that I wanted to do that and still teach. So, you know, teaching is great, but it takes a great deal of time, and it controls your time as well. You have to obviously adapt to a semester schedule, and I just, you know, as I say, I want to do more on how do we take biophilia and make it more robust, more experientially
right.
available in our lives, particularly in the context of the built environment, which has become our world today. And so I've gotten very involved in something I call biophilic design, which is the application of biophilia in the built environment.
So looking down the road, you know, 20, 30, 50 years, what does an urban environment look like, or even a rural one, with biophilic design and principles in mind?
One can, sort of try to envision what that might be like. In my book, Birthright, I start out with a future scenario. I have a young child who's growing up with his family in Denver, and this is in like 2020 or 2040. I can't remember what I had there. I think it was 2040, mm-hmm. and which I tried to envision what a city would be like that had embraced biophilic principles, where the ongoing experience was an integral everyday part of people's lives, even in the most urbanized environments, and where it even to the point where in this kind of this fantasy of mine, I envisioned the elk that winter in the high country having access again to the in the wintertime to the lower elevation areas, the shortgrass prairie, actually being able to migrate through the city, and talking about the various kinds of structures, whether they be residential structures or office structures or schools or, you know, et cetera, that would what they would be like in a world that was both low environmental impact, but as you're trying to minimize and avoid adverse effects on the natural environment in your constructions, but also ongoing positive, affirmative, beneficial contact with nature was also a part of those constructions. And again, whether it be an office environment or a residential one, those were the two that I sort of focused on in that sort of fantasy of a Denver of some decades from now. So what would it look like? As I say, nature would not be something that you visited as a kind of or something that was outside of or separate from people. It would become an integral part of people's everyday experience and lives and the way. And you could do this whether it be in a high-rise construction or in a more integrated residential environment where nature was built into the experience of everyday life.
Right. I mean, if I have to live in an urban setting in my final days, all I want is a beehive, a bird feeder, and a butterfly garden, and I think I could satisfy a lot of primordial desires for nature.
Absolutely. And, you know, those are all direct contact, and that's you know, marvelously important, you know, when you can interact with animals that are kind of free roaming in a sense, like a butterfly or a bee, but also, you know, the indirect experience of nature where we kind of experience it in a highly controlled and managed circumstance, whether it be potted plants or in a, aquarium. Or, you know, the vicarious experience is also very, very important, the representational, you know, whether it be, everything from obvious things like pictures and ornamentation to less obvious things like the materials that we have in our furnishings, in our carpeting and our coverings and our curtains and the ways in which we've drawn inspiration from nature in the shapes and forms of everything from, you know, whether it be lamps or the shapes of buildings or the shapes of rooms or the curvature or the arches of passageways or transitional environments like balconies and colonnades. And, and there's so many different ways in which we can bring nature into our lives that are very obvious that are less apparent but draw inspiration from the natural world.
So, Professor Keller, we have to start wrapping up, but I have one last question for you. The dedication of your book in the front is to four different organisms, and you list their scientific names. So
right.
What's the significance of these? Are they particularly special to you?
Yeah, no, obviously. There were a couple animals in there. There was a Rocky Mountain elk steelhead, is a fish, you know, right. Salmon, trout, there are a couple of plants. I think the common names were skunk cabbage and Dutchman's breeches, and these for various reasons, you know, various historical and personal reasons were all important to me . I put the Latin names down just to make it a little bit more cryptic. But,
well, it caught my attention. I had to look them all up. So
I did something also that I think you'll find amusing. Dutchman's breeches are a beautiful little flower. That's one of the first things that come up in the spring here, and it was especially a delight this year when we had such a long winter, cold winter. But I figured they're every bit as much Dutch women's breeches as Dutch men's breeches, so I put a little extra you won't find it in the Latin classification for that particular species, so I put a little F in there to suggest it might be a Dutch woman's breeches.
I like that.
Dr. Stephen Keller, he is professor emeritus at the Yale School of Forestry and the author of the book Birthright: People and Nature in the Modern World. It's just out in its paperback form today. That's correct. And Dr. Keller, again, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Well, you're welcome, and I appreciate your being interested in my book. And I didn't know this was the first day of the paperback edition. That's great to hear.
According to your publicist, today is the first day.
Yet another reason to listen to our show. Thanks, Dr. Keller.
Thank you for joining
us.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters, and we come back. We got a bunch of news items to cover. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak, Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. And we got some news items to cover.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
I'm going to start with a quick one.
Oh, yeah.
So today...
Is this breaking news?
Breaking news. We could never have anticipated this. Today is Rachel Carson's 107th birthday. So,
and she is.
Yeah, who
and she's
is
important
that?
Because
she's today's Google Doodle. That's why it matters. She was an American marine biologist and conservationist whose book Silent Spring and some of her other work mm-hmm. are credited with sort of sparking the environmental movement.
Absolutely.
So, Silent really Spring important is, figure in was, conservation.
One of the important books of that I read when I was like a freshman in college. Back in the late 70s.
Back in the Stone Age.
Yeah, when they still had paper, notebooks in paper form. So, yeah, she was very important in helping to, motivate me to pursue an education, a career, and a professional career in the environmental field.
Yeah, so, that's right. So happy birthday.
Always happy birthday, Rachel Carson. So let's turn to some news that Rachel would probably be either – vastly disappointed by or encouraged, depending on how you want to look at these things. I'll start with carbon dioxide, the latest on carbon dioxide. We like to cover that every year or so, every
That's
spring.
Right.
Northern Hemisphere hits carbon dioxide milestone in April. Carbon dioxide levels throughout the Northern Hemisphere hit 400 parts per million for the first time in human history in April. This is according to the World Meteorological Organization. Now, I think it was last year that the observatory in Hawaii, the Keeling Curve.
Right.
Okay. They hit 400 parts per million on a single
– On
basically,
a single point.
A single point for the first time last year. Now, 400 parts per million is being observed around the globe in the Northern Hemisphere, not in the Southern Hemisphere yet because much more carbon dioxide is emitted in the Northern Hemisphere than the Southern. But the concentrations of carbon dioxide continue to grow. The 400 part per million level is up 40% since wide use of fossil fuels began in the Industrial Revolution back in the early 20th century. And it was first recorded in 2012 in the Arctic, and since then it's been kind of migrating south. Interesting.
Slowly mixing.
So we're at 400 parts per million pretty much on average in the Northern Hemisphere, which is not surprised because last year that's the way the curve is
right.
is moving.
We're heading in that direction.
And in that direction. And sure enough, it's happening. So,
well, Bill McKibben and 350.org certainly have some work to do.
Yeah, we zoomed by that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's 450.
Hopefully we can get back there.
That's interesting you mentioned that now because the UN's panel of climate experts said that greenhouse gas concentrations led by carbon dioxide would have to be kept below 450 to give a good chance of keeping the temperature rise below 2 degrees centigrade, or roughly 3.8 degrees or so Fahrenheit.
Well, we better act fast.
We're already at about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
So we're over halfway there.
Yeah. So are we almost halfway there? Yeah.
Yes, that's the day. But that's the latest on carbon dioxide. What's next?
So we have a couple of other stories today about, like, that fall into this category of people altering the basic systems of our Earth and her
fundamental structures of the planet.
Exactly. You know, the things you can count on, we can no longer count on, I think. So this one has to do with the rising of mountains and the falling of valleys being caused by humans. You know, we used to think this was like tectonic plate movement only.
Yeah.
But a new study suggests that extracting water for human activities in California is causing mountains to rise and the valleys to drop. The lead author, Dr. Colin Amos, explains, we are removing a weight from the Earth's crust, so the weight of all that water, and the crust is responding by flexing upwards and literally moving mountains. He continued, it seems as though these small stress changes that happen on a yearly basis are causing more small earthquakes to occur on portions of the fault as well. And so for now, the effects are small, but they could increase in the future. Mm-hmm. And in a minute, we'll talk a little bit more about this relationship between some of the changes we're making and earthquakes.
Continue the California theme. But I just want to understand. So the drawing of groundwater.
Right.
Millions and billions of gallons of groundwater throughout the state.
For agriculture and drinking water. And
fracking.
Irrigation.
And, is actually, I could see where the land is sinking. But he's also suggesting that it's making mountains rise. It's throwing off the whole
The Earth's crust
plate.
Is becoming lighter. In that area without the water, and so it's kind of
moving. We act in a collective fashion. Just think of the things we can do to the planet.
I know. It's a little bit scary.
We can make it rise and fall. All right, so staying with that in California, last week the U.S. Drought Monitor report showed grim news for California. 100% of the state is now in severe or higher drought, up from 95%.
Oh, boy.
Yes. Let's see. During the most recent California rainy season, that's October through April, so it's done, the state received 10.4 inches of precipitation, which is roughly half of the average for that period of time. And now the rainy season is effectively done, and now they're in their quote-unquote dry season, which they will probably see very little rainfall, very little precipitation, particularly in the southern part of the state. Let's see. The snow survey, the water content and the snow was 18% of average. And this is in California again. The 2014 drought has cost the state $3.6 billion in agricultural damages. But here's the good news. Cal Fire recently announced it had hired 125 additional firefighters to help address increased fire threat. So you see, the state of California is moving from kind of an agricultural economy to a fire-based economy.
Oh,
that's if I was at the Heartland Institute, that's what I would be talking about.
All of the new jobs.
It's a spin.
Yeah.
It's all about the spin. So that's what's going on in California.
Well, it makes us feel lucky here in Utah.
I think so. We're not as bad as that.
Right.
And we'll get more from Brian McInerney next month when he's on to give us the update on water conditions here in the state.
Yeah, we always like that seasonal update from Brian on the state of our reservoirs and groundwater and all those kinds of things.
I tell you what, let's take a quick break for a couple underwriters and come back. We've got a couple more news items to cover. Stay tuned. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to the ReStore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to the ReStore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson. That's Chris Cherniak. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure we take a minute to thank our brand new crack research team, EJ Elliott, who's also here with us in the studio today.
Yes, EJ. Thanks for doing EJ's helping us as a summer intern.
That's right.
He's going to the University of Virginia, studying environmental science and such. And yes, say yes. And right now, helping us doing our research on our news stories, etc. So thank you, EJ, for helping us out.
That's right.
Eventually, you'll be sharing those news stories with us. You'll be on our roundtable discussion. We're going to be.
That's right. In a few weeks, EJ will be
joining us
on the spot.
Exactly.
Front and center.
So, but in the meantime, we got a few more items to cover.
That's right. That's right. Continuing along the same vein of people creating earthquakes, as fracking or, hydraulic fracturing is taking place, we've talked a lot about that, and it's continuing to increase in the U.S. And as that's increased, so have the number of earthquakes. So new research being presented at the annual meeting of the Seismological Society of America shows that wastewater disposal wells, which are deep holes that are drilled to hold hundreds of millions of gallons of fluid produced by oil and gas wells, they may be changing the stress of existing fault lines. Mm. So scientists haven't been able to confirm a connection between increased quake activity and wastewater disposal sites associated with oil and gas wells, but they're still trying to figure out what might be the connection there. And in Ohio, the state has actually shut down a group of wells that are strongly suspected of causing quakes in the area.
Right. Ohio is requiring monitoring. If any quakes are detected, they require monitoring by the drillers. And they have the latitude to
They're not allowed to stop the stop the operations if the seismic monitors detect a quake.
Yeah. So it's happening. There, and in some cases in Oklahoma and such, it's going on, and you see more of it. So, all right, so that's the fragging thing. The next one is this one is I'm sure most of you have heard about this, the Antarctic, the West Antarctic ice sheet that collapsed. This is basically last week it was first reported. Retreat of ice in the Amundsen Sea, which is almost as big as France.
So this is relatively big scale.
Practically as big as France. Yes. It's huge. And the thing is, it's deemed as irreversible and will likely swell the world's oceans by as much as 4 feet. Now, the encouraging news, if there is for this, is the fact that this may not occur – this won't occur for decades, if not centuries. So it's not going to happen within the next 10 or 20 or 40 years. But it's melting. The point is, it's melting and it can't be stopped.
Right. It's past the tipping point.
Yeah. There you go.
But I mean, it has massive implications for where people can live, too, when you think of the cities that we live in that are just a couple of feet above sea level.
And that's a good point, because people tend to think that, it's rising sea level will be like 3 or 4 inches. Big deal. So part of my beach gets washed away.
Right.
But there's not only a physical aspect to it, but a chemical and biological consequences too, because groundwater will be impacted by seawater, the migration of seawater into otherwise freshwater zones.
Right. Storm swells will be that much higher.
And then there's biological impacts as saltwater, freshwater interfaces and estuaries and tidal areas shift, and that shifts all the biological systems. So there's a wholesale change that goes on, and Florida is always kind of the ground zero of that ongoing experiment that's going to unfold. So the impacts just aren't, few inch rise in sea level. Oh, I'll deal with it so it floods a little
right.
bit. So, okay. All right, what else? We got time for one more news item.
Well, we can talk about maybe some increased funding for wind energy.
Okay.
This is something that EJ, of course, prepared for us today. And I'm just going to pull this up.
Okay.
So last week, the Department of Energy pledged up to $47 million to three offshore wind development projects. And some of these projects are the kinds of things that have really pitted environmentalists against each other.
Yeah.
Because, you know, wind projects, obviously, it's a renewable source of energy. You're not using fossil fuels. That's great. But it also can impact the seabed, the view shed, the aesthetic.
Yeah.
Not in my backyard.
Not in my, says.
Yeah.
The Kennedys.
So these grants in particular are helping projects off the coast of New Jersey, your home state, Chris, Oregon, and Virginia with plans to
begin. That would improve the view shed.
Improve the view shed from New Jersey.
Yeah.
So with plans to begin delivering electricity by 2017, they represent the next phase of the Energy Department's push to stimulate the industry and decrease the cost of offshore wind power to be competitive with conventional electricity production. And the Department of Energy is also working with two other projects.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking, you know, further down the road in Maine and Lake Erie.
Yeah. No shortage of opportunities in the areas of wind and solar continues. Although $47 million, that's like a month's worth of, but you know, they should add a zero behind that. They really were motivated and sincere. You said 47 million.
Yeah.
It should be 470 million.
Oh, I see. Zero. Okay.
Yeah. After that, 47. All right. We got one more. Here's some encouraging news from China. We do our, you know, almost on a weekly basis. We bash China for one environmental issue or another. But they just established a court consisting of 12 specialist consultants who will assist litigators on technical issues on environmental crime. So they've established an environmental court. So if you're a polluter in China, you can actually go to environmental court and face the consequences, which typically include things like death penalty.
Jeez.
It's happened.
Serious.
Environmental scandals have plagued China in recent years. It's no surprise as the country pursued a strategy of high growth, rapid industrialization. Faced with growing anger over pollution, Beijing has adopted a more environmentally friendly strategy, and they've set up these courts that are designed to bring environmental polluters to justice. To justice.
That's
Thank
right.
you very much. So that's good news from China.
That's right. Well, I think it's time for us to start wrapping up.
Yeah, let's take you have a
quick break.
All right, we'll do one last break, and we'll come back. I got another item and a wrap-up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to start wrapping up. What's on the mountain life tomorrow?
That's right. Tomorrow at 9 a.m., the mountain life will be speaking with the guy from Man on Wire. Do you remember that documentary about the guy that walks across the wire between the Twin Towers in 1974? So they're going to be speaking with Philip Pettit.
Philippe Petit.
Oh.
It's the friend.
Well,
Philippe
are
Petit.
We speaking an American or?
This is America.
Philippe.
Your last name's
Petit.
Pettit. Philippe Petit. Him? You're talking to
him?
Actually,
you wouldn't say that T if we're going to get technical here.
Oh, God. All right.
But he's written a book on creativity, and he'll be on the show to talk about that tomorrow.
Okay.
And then they'll also have a guest who wrote a book called Drunk Mom, which is a revealing book about functional alcoholism.
Okay.
So Drunk Mom and
High Wire
a book on creativity tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's right.
They all go together.
Sounds
somehow
like a good one.
On the mountain life. All right, we got 30 seconds to wrap up. Let's thank our underwriters. They include Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanities Restore,
Vail Resorts,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and Prudential Utah Real Estate.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
We'll see you all next week.